Welcome to episode 185 of the Martin Bailey Photography Podcast. I'm sure there isn't a listener on the show that hasn't heard of Scott Bourne. Scott is a new media producer, consultant, photographer, author, lecturer, teacher, enthusiast of all technology stuff, and president of Bourne Media Group. Today, I'm honored, humbled, and really excited to welcome Scott Bourne to the show. Welcome, Scott.
Well, thank you. I'm honored to be on the show with you, Martin. We had an interview we did with you over at Twip Photo on the blog, and I got lots of very positive feedback. Your fans really, really love you, so I'm glad to be on the show with you.
And that's really nice of you to say. I was very touched by all of those comments that we received for that as well, and I do thank you for the interview. It was great.
Yeah, I next time I feel like saying something that's going to get me in trouble, I might put your name on it, though, because you're too beloved.
Put my name anywhere you like, Scott. And, you know, if I can jump onto your marketing bandwagon in any way, it helps me for sure. So before we sort of get into the photography stuff, you know, I realized that, you know, when we were communicating a while back, you told me that you lived here in Tokyo in the Ginza area when you were a kid. And I just wondering if you got any funny stories or interesting stories from that time or after that.
Well, actually, I lived there three different times. My dad was a lawyer, and he practiced international law, and he had some work in Tokyo. So I can't remember. I think it was like the third, the fifth grade, and my junior year of high school. Those 3 years I lived in Tokyo, went to the American school, and it was not exactly all welcome and yellow roses and glad to see you. It was more like, Gaijing, what are you doing in my neighborhood?
Yeah, yeah.
It was a bit of a rude awakening, but generally I really enjoyed my time in Japan. I've been back to visit several times. It's a very polite society, as you know, and people in general, I was pretty amazed at how well things worked. But I did always get a kick out of, you know, I was 6'1", 280, 270 when I played football, and people would actually walk up to me and ask for my autograph thinking I was famous, because over there, if you got size, you're either a sumo wrestler or an American football player. And, you know, that was always kind of funny to me. When I was a junior in high school, I was a real big boy, and I was pretty much solid muscle. I was playing competitive football back in the States. Wow. And when I went to the American school there was not much of a football team.
Yeah, I can imagine. They still have the American schools here. I'm sure the attitude towards the gaijin has changed slightly now, but you know, it's still a society where, you know, even I've lived here for it must be a good 18 years or so now.
Wow.
You still get people sort of, you know, you're always conscious that you're not Japanese, that you're an outsider, as they say, you know. So, but it's, you know, I love living here, so it's I'm happy that we've got this this sort of common ground.
I wish we could move mass quantities of people from downtown to the airport in Seattle as well as they do in Tokyo. I'll tell you that.
That's hopefully going to get better. They're building out the second airport here as well. As you know, I mean, I know that you've been to Japan since then, but the Narita Airport is way out of the city.
It's
in a different prefecture, so
yeah,
that can be improved. So that's great. So let's talk about what got you into photography in the first place, Scott.
Well, I had a very strong interest in communicating. I was involved and interested in radio, and I just really liked anything that involved communication. I picked up a camera. One of my girlfriend's father was a sports photographer at the Indianapolis Star and News newspaper, and he gave me an old Nikromat and said, go have fun. About that time, I had a half-sister who was married to a guy who was the editor of the Bloomington Herald Tribune, which is a newspaper in southern Indiana. And there are small town newspapers where Indiana University is located. And he knew I was interested in photography, and I'd turned 16. And he said, would you like to cover the Indianapolis 500 for us? We don't have any money to send somebody up there, but I can get you in. Mm. I said, sure, I don't know what I'm doing, but what the heck? So I went in, and I had the official credential to get all the way down into the pits, which is the hardest one to get. And if you made it that far, both Nikon and Canon had you know, their services there, and they were trying to get everybody to shoot their cameras so they could show that the pros use their gear. So they upgraded me to, I believe it was an F1, or I don't think it was even an F1. I can't remember what the body was at the time, but I know that it had a motor drive that went a whole 1.5 frames per second that you attached to the body. And they gave me a 200 millimeter F4 to use, and they sent me out there, and I started taking pictures, and Tom Sneva had the good grace to crash into the short shoot of turn two right in front of me, and I had a newspaper sale. Every single paper in the country ran with that photo, and I thought, man, this is cool. I'm going to be a famous photographer. And, you know, I got paid $2,000, which in 1970s money was like $2 million. Wow. And to a 16-year-old kid, that was like – well, to put it in perspective, I could have bought a brand-new Camaro for $2,300.
Wow.
So it was a lot of money, and I thought, man, this is cool. Instead of saving it for college, I'm going to buy all this camera gear and be a big pro. And it was like 2.5 years before I ever sold another picture.
Yeah, well, I guess that's a testament to sort of, you know, some people like to say that look has nothing to do with photography. And
I think you've
got to be obviously in the right place at the right time. Some of that has got to do with look. But, I mean, you do have to have the technical ability to capture the shot when it happens. There's no doubt about the technical aspect, but you know, those things, like you say, just being at that right, at that place at the right time, it probably changed your life.
Oh, it did. I mean, and I can tell you what else changed my life. If Tom Sneva had not gotten on it a little bit in turn two and hit that wall, I'd probably be a lawyer in Santa Monica right now.
Right. Right. I thought you were going to say if he'd come over the wall, you would have been dead or something like that. But so,
well, there is that. The funny story is that when the wheel broke loose of his car, it zinged by me close enough that I felt the wind of it. I was too young and too stupid to realize that I was standing out on the infield grass very close to the track without any protection. In fact, nowadays they won't let you do that.
Really?
Yeah, they can't stand where I was standing at the time I took that picture.
Wow. Okay, that's really cool. So, I know that, you know, you've had a lot of varied sort of photographic genres that you've been involved with over the years. You know, but I'm sort of very much, the majority of what I shoot is nature photography. So I was wondering if we could talk a little bit about nature photography from your side. And I was wondering, you know, is there like one shot or location that really sticks in your mind? And if there is, why is that?
Yeah, I switched to doing nature and primarily wildlife, which is my current specialty, in the mid-90s. Mm-hmm. And my favorite place, I mean, even before the mid-90s, I had been visiting a place called Bosque del Apache, New Mexico. Mm-hmm. And it's just south of Albuquerque, about an hour. It's a national wildlife refuge. Mm-hmm. And it is just an amazing, amazing place. Every year, hundreds of thousands of birds migrate through there during Thanksgiving time, and I love it. And I can easily name my favorite shot. I got it this year. I've been trying for 12 years at this place to get a shot of these backlit cranes in this pond when the sunrise comes up. And I made the shot called Cranes in the Fire Mist on Thanksgiving Day.
Yeah.
And that's easily my favorite shot because I've been working at getting that shot, Martin, for 12 years.
I've seen that shot on the web. It is a beautiful image, Scott. I can see exactly why this is your favorite. If I'd shot this, I'd probably would be, I don't know, I'd have had a heart attack or something at the time.
Well, I almost did have a heart attack because there's about 9 things that have to happen just right, none of which I can control. For this to happen. And I kept going to this place. My friend Artie Morris, who's someone who has done some teaching for me, he's taught me, especially what I know about bird photography. He's responsible for about half of it. He had a shot 2 years before I started thinking about this one, and it was similar, but it didn't have birds flying through the shot. And in my mind, I always had envisioned the birds flying through the shot. And I'd been able to get most of this photograph several times, but I'd never got the one with the birds flying in the shot. And unfortunately, none of the Canadian geese that I was, you know, trying to get a hold of would accept my email and fly through when I told them. So,
yeah, this is it's one of those shots. Just it sticks in your memory. I imagine, you know, I mean, that this mist, is this caused by, like, is it early morning or is it just cold?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, for this to work, it has to be exactly 32 degrees Fahrenheit. because that's the time at which the temperature difference between the water and the cold air causes this mist and this fog.
Right, and
it's all these birds are standing in a pond. And I'll be glad to share with people the location. This is what's known as the North Railroad Pond at Bosque del Apache. Those of you who've been there know where that is, I guess. It's across from what we call the Ed Crane Pools. And there's thousands of sandhill cranes. These are actually lesser sandhill cranes, Ross's geese, and snow geese. So those are the three primary species you see there. And the sun has just come up. And for this to work, Martin, it can be no clouds, because if there's clouds, we're going to get purple and blue and, you know, all kinds of neat colors. But to get this golden color, we have to have a bald blue sky and this get the yellow sun that creates this golden color. So I got that. The winds had to be coming out of the northwest in order to get the birds to be flying the direction I wanted them to. It had to be cold enough to generate the mist. The birds had to be there in the first place. They had to not take off. And literally, just about 30 seconds after I made this photograph, every single bird was out of that scene.
Oh wow! Yeah, that's amazing. I've not shot in that part of the world, but definitely at some point I'd love to go.
Worth the trip, my friend. Worth the trip. I've been there 17 years in a row. Every Thanksgiving Day, I start a workshop there with Artie Morris, and this year will be no exception. And I love it.
Yeah, it's an amazing place. I can see. So let's move on then. I think we're already touching on some of this stuff, but what do you think makes a good wildlife photograph?
A good photograph of wildlife tells the animal story, in my opinion, Martin. I like to think of wildlife photography the same way I used to think of wedding photography. My job as a photographer there is to basically tell the story of the subject, and I have a real soft place in my heart for doing wildlife photography, because unlike brides, who are able to talk and usually exercise that ability quite well, the animals can't talk and can't speak for themselves. So as a photographer who specializes in wildlife, a lot of what I do is in effect talking for the animals, because we live in this world where, you know, you go to McDonald's and you do the drive-in and you get your news compressed into USA Today, and we even have drive-in weddings in parts of the United States. Everybody's in a hurry and you don't notice the beauty around you, and you really can't notice the beauty in birds, for instance, because they're flying by at 20 miles an hour and you can't see every detail. In wildlife photography, we can freeze that and you can count the feathers underneath the beak of an eagle, and you can start to see the magnificence of these animals. So I think a good wildlife photographer has to be somebody who wants to tell the story of the animal. I have this little thing every time, and I know it's ridiculous and I can't help it, but every time I take a picture of a new subject, I say, smile, I'm going to make you famous.
that's cool. I wish they knew, you know, some of the birds and the creatures that we shoot, they end up all over the place. I wish they knew.
Yeah. So there, I do believe that there are some animals that know I mean them no harm, and will, you know, I've been able to get amazingly close to some animals that you wouldn't think could happen. I think sometimes they do know your heart.
I'm sure they do. I think they can sense it. I've heard somewhere as well that they can sense fear, and they often take that as anger and sort of try to, you know, I think they can smell it or something, some hormone or something like that. And so if you get scared when you're around them, that can often make them skitty. And if you feel comfortable with them, then obviously there's no fear there. And so they don't smell that or sense it or whatever. So I think that might be part of it as well.
Yeah, definitely there are animals, particularly wolves, who definitely smell fear and will react to it. That's for sure.
Yeah. I've seen some of your wolf shots and your bear shots as well. I mean, those guys will harm you. Imagine if you're close enough. Have you ever had any sort of, you know, experiences with that?
Well, I've never been harmed, thank goodness. Yeah. I've been bluff charged by bears. If you know bear behavior, that's one of the signs that they're not happy with you. And I was charged in the Ohanapakash River at Mount Rainier one year by a very hungry black bear. He had been separated from his mother. He was a subadult male. He was confused and scared and hungry, and I don't know what had happened to his mother. Maybe she died. Maybe he got lost. But he was someplace he wasn't supposed to be at the time of year I was there, and he was starving, and I think he saw me as a giant pancake, he came running at me. And when I'm in the wilderness by myself, I always carry military grade CS gas with me. Mm. And in the case of a small black bear, that's more than enough. Now, when I went to Alaska this last summer and went up to Katmai, where we've got the 1,000-pound grizzlies, who don't even bring the CS gas or the tear gas or the mace because all they do is laugh at you. You're not going to impress a grizzly bear by hitting. You probably just make him mad. So up there, there's nothing but air between you and the bear, and you just got to rely on the fact that they prefer to eat the salmon than you and don't do anything stupid. We had our expedition in a spit there in August. We were surrounded by 21, coastal brown bears. And we never had any problem. We did have a couple of cubs walk up to us, and that's not good because then mom thinks that we walked up to them, and she just blayed a little bit at us. And we had one subadult male that was a little bit angry with us, and he stood up on his hind legs and made sure we knew that he was the king and all that. Mm. But I've never been harmed. I've been close. Had some run-ins with some elephants in Africa one time, and they don't really know whether they're going to kill you or not because they can't even see you. But all in all, it's not been. I'm still here, so I guess it's okay.
Yeah, you shot that, as in you photographed that bear that stood up, right? I think I've seen a photograph of
that. Yeah, that's on my photo shelter site. He was stand. In all these cases, I'm a photographer first and a human being second, which I don't know is if that's the best strategy, because I wasn't the least bit afraid that this 10-foot tall bear was, 40 feet in front of me, standing up and screaming at me. I was like, oh, what a cool shot.
I guess that's one of the things that makes a good wildlife photographer, though. That you need to be able to do that instead of like running away when something happens.
Yeah, there's a couple of funny things that happened. I'm one of those guys, Martin. I rather, I look at the camping to me is the Holiday Inn instead of the Hilton. I'm not much for roughing it these days. So we had two nice yachts to sleep on at night on the water where it was safe. Mm. But in the morning, we would take a skiff over to the spit where we would stay all day. And during one of the sessions, somehow a very large grizzly got between us and the skiff. Mm. And just sort of sat down in front of it as if to say, you're not leaving yet.
Amazing.
He took over the skiff.
Wow. That's amazing. So, I think that, many professionals in other photographic fields tend to view nature photography and wildlife photography as a bit of a lesser genre. And I was wondering if you've felt that yourself. And if you have, why do you think that is?
Well, first of all, I'm not the kind of guy that cares what the other photographers think of my work. But to the degree that they feel that, I guess it's because they know that if you're a wedding photographer in Seattle, you're probably making some pretty good coin. And very few people are able to make a living as a nature photographer, whereas just about anybody with a digital SLR and a reasonable amount of marketing skill can pull down a six-figure income as a wedding photographer.
I see.
And if you go to the local camera stores, like the big camera store in Seattle is called Glazer's, it's the wedding photographers that are there buying gear, and it's the nature photographers that are dreaming about it.
Okay, this is starting to make sense. I've never seen it. I've never looked at it from that angle.
that's to the degree. But I don't care. I do really well as a nature photographer. I'm very lucky that way. But it's mostly marketing, and I teach a business class sometimes up here at the Seattle Photographic Center, and a couple of times I've done it at Tacoma Community College and University of Washington even. And I tell them, no matter what the genre you're in, the truth about professional photography is this: 80% of it's sales, 20% of it's photography. I'd much rather be a good salesman than a good photographer. I can always learn the photography part.
Without doubt. I was going to ask you about the business aspect. And, I know that you're like undoubtedly one of the masters of marketing. I've just ordered your Secrets to Selling and Publishing Photography CD, the one that you did from on lynda.com. I've just ordered that from Amazon.
My publisher and I thank you for that. Thank you.
I'm looking forward to getting stuck into that. I was checking out the first few chapters that you can listen to free of charge as like a tester on lynda.com. So I'm really looking forward to getting stuck into that. But I did want to talk a little bit more about the business of photography. You were saying, 80%, the 80-20 rule. That's one of those things that comes up a lot in business. But I'm, I know, I totally agree. Obviously, I, I, I know that you know it's very important to do the marketing stuff. The main reason I started this podcast, apart from the fact that I wanted to share my thoughts and just be open, I was never one for keeping things to myself. But one of the main side reasons was for marketing. I'll be open about that. And I was just wondering if there's any other advice that you have for the nature photographer, I guess for photographers in general, who's sort of trying to make the way in photography, trying to make the name in the business and build a sustainable business.
It really just boils down to sales and marketing. And unfortunately, artists tend to say, "Ooh, I don't want to have to sell anything." Well, you better pay somebody to sell for you then, because you're going to be lonely otherwise. This is really about smiling and dialing, Martin. I get up at 4:30 every morning because it's 7:30 in New York, and I start dialing editors and publishers and pitching them ideas, and I do that about 6 hours a day.
Wow.
And if I don't do that, then I won't sell any photographs, because I've tried extrasensory perception. ESP doesn't work. there's nobody to do it but me, so I do it. And that's, I can tell you right now, I'm fairly successful at the sales, but there are many photographers who I would consider to be far better than me at the photographic part. But I do better at the sales part, so my images are the ones that are published. And while that may not seem fair, that's the way life is. So I would tell everybody that's interested in getting into this, forget about buying your next camera. Start looking for a Zig Ziglar book on sales.
I totally agree. I try a lot to be a better marketer, but there's still a lot to do. And I'm sure that, 6 hours a day on the phone would probably kill me. So,
that's what everybody says. See,
hats off to you there, Scott.
Well, it's not only on the phone, it's 6 hours on the phone and doing things like a podcast and the blog. Those all help. Yeah. But the simplest thing I say when you get my lynda.com title, you'll hear me say this: show the work, show the work, show the work, show the work, show the work. If you don't show the work, you can't sell the work. So every chance you can, show the work, because if somebody sees an image that resonates with them, then they'll buy it. And people tend to think, oh, well, nobody wants to buy nature photography. It's not true. We sell pictures here every day. We do prints. We sell prints all day, every day here. And it's only because we are very aggressive about showing those pictures and making sure that the buyers who are interested in them get a chance to see them.
Mm. Yeah. I mean your images are beautiful as well, so that's going to help. But I totally agree. It's something that many people don't do, even including myself. Wrapped up in too many other things. But I really thank you for that advice.
Well, I'm happy to offer it. I think that I want to see everybody succeed. The more nature photographers succeed, the easier my job will actually be, because then I won't have to compete with people who are willing to let go of an image for $50 because they want to see an ego credit in Outdoor Photographer magazine.
Yeah, that's so true. That's so true. So what does it take for a photographer to get a book published these days? I know it's getting more and more difficult.
It's very hard. And I have to say that sometimes getting a book published, if you're doing it because you want to make money, boy howdy, it's you're not going to make a lot of money. You're going to end up working for about 10, 15 bucks an hour if you're lucky. Because photography books just don't become bestsellers. Oprah doesn't pick photography books as her book of the month.
Yeah.
It's very hard. Most photography books sell 2,000 to 4,000 copies. That's the serious truth. There are exceptions. Obviously, Joe McNally's new book is going to do much better than that. Yeah. And there are some superstars who can sell a lot of books here and there. But generally, you do books based on what I was just talking about. You do books because you want to show the work. You do books for the credibility. And you do books because you want people to know that you're serious. And you sometimes the best reason, Martin, in my opinion, to do a book is just that as a shooter, you tend to focus your energy better when you have a project in mind rather than willy-nilly walking around with a camera going, "What should I photograph today?"
Yeah, I'm with you. So it's as much to help the creative process as it is probably more to help the creative process than it is to make money.
If you're tempted to say, "Oh, I think I'll run over to Mount Rainier and see what the waterfalls look like today," but you're working on a book of wolves and there's no wolves in Mount Rainier, it helps you time management wise to say, "No, I'm not going to be tempted to go shoot a pretty picture in Mount Rainier. I'm going to edit my wolf book."
Yeah.
Those are the kinds of processes that I put myself through to make sure that I stay focused. I've had 4 books published and 3 training titles at lynda.com, so 7 published pieces. Mm. And I made some money here and there on them, but main reason I did them was, you know, for credibility and because I do like to teach, and to the degree that they're teaching books, I think it does help some people to have access to that information. But it's harder and harder. You have to make a book proposal. And really, it goes back to marketing. That's the answer to your question. Sorry to take so long to get to it. But it goes back to marketing. If you want to get a book published, you need to present a marketing plan to the publisher that shows exactly how, why, and where this book is going to sell.
I see.
That's what they want to know, because they're going to take a huge risk to print it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And despite the fact that they're going to tell you that they'll help you with the marketing, that amounts to one young college graduate just out of school trying to help 20 photographers get their books marketed who has little experience and won't do much more than issue a press release. It's always on you as the author to arrange the tours, to get out there and get interviewed. So I would look at some of these books on, once again, marketing, not photography. Yeah. Find a book on business plans or marketing plans or sales plans. Use that to create sort of a runway that you're going to use to launch your book proposal to the publisher and show them that you've thought about the marketing. For instance, if you have a sponsor for your podcast, Martin, let's just say Nikon was your sponsor. Mm. You would go to them and say, would you be interested in actually helping me sponsor my book? That's one new way that we're starting to see books get published. You'll see a photo book with a couple of ads in it.
I see. Yeah.
And that ad helps to cover the very high printing and distribution cost. You have to understand, at least in the way the books are sold in the United States, As the author, you might be lucky to get 7 to 10 cents on the buck.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it's like it goes to the publisher takes half right off the bat. So if you see $29.95 on the book cover, half of that's gone. Now, Barnes & Noble takes half.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? The distributor between the publisher and Barnes & Noble, they take half too.
Yeah.
So when it's all said and done, you're getting pennies.
Yeah, I'm with you.
It might make more sense these days with the ability to electronically publish. Yeah. If you have an audience like you do or like I do with that's substantial and independent of the traditional bookstore crowd, it might make more sense to try to sell ebooks or other kinds of publications because you can actually make more money. Now, you won't get the credibility you would get of having your book show up on Amazon or in Barnes & Noble, but you will get dollars.
Yeah. I've actually been toying with the idea of doing one through a company here in Japan who, you know, it's a self-publishing sort of thing, but if they like the content, what they do is they take a slightly larger cut, I think, but then they do all of the public, they do a lot of the marketing for it. And I've got a friend who's just released a big show and a book and everything. I've got 2 copies next to me actually, because I helped him with the English, but this friend has told me about a lot of the stuff they do, and they do help a lot. But the problem with me here in Japan is that they're mostly Japan only, and they, you know, I don't believe that we can get these things on Amazon and stuff. It's all very domestic here. So
it's going to be a harder challenge because each country has different arrangements with Amazon, just like they do with iTunes. All the time people will tell me, you know, how'd you buy that album? It's not on iTunes over here. Well, that's because they have different clearances they get based on the various copyright restrictions, contracts, you know, laws, etc. So there are distribution issues. And the real problem, of course, is that you ship these books overseas and it very quickly becomes more expensive. The price of shipping becomes more expensive than the cover price of the book.
Yeah. Lots of stuff to think about here, and I'm sure that this is helping a lot of my listeners as well.
I hope so. I hate to sound negative. I wish there were better news, but I don't want to mislead anybody into thinking it's real easy, because it isn't.
No, absolutely. I think a dose of reality is definitely necessary in a lot of the business aspects of photography.
It's very hard work for very little money, and everybody wants to do it. Yeah. There's the bad news.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, I know that you'd also mentioned in communication a while back that you do most of what you do for the love of photography, and I think that's such I definitely think that that's more so for yourself, but I think that it's a big driver for a lot of people as well. So,
well, I used to say before I started becoming financially successful at photography, I used to say I get paid in sunshine. And I have had some tremendous experience. I have photographs of me playing with baby wolves, baby mountain lions, baby black bears. How many people have ever even seen one outside of a zoo, let alone got to play with one?
Exactly, yeah.
And, you know, it is a very fulfilling thing to be able to, in particularly when I'm working with the animals, to think about trying to preserve and protect, you know, what they stand for and give people some sort of idea of these animals' lives beyond what they're familiar with. And there is a lot of satisfaction in that. Now, I'm just very lucky in that I am able to get some money for it too. But I would literally do almost everything I do now at this stage of my life photographically for the love of it. And I think unless your passion in your life is your work, that you're going to have trouble being successful at it. When you get to the point that you can truly, and I mean not just say this, but believe it in your heart that you're doing it for the love of it, that's when all of a sudden the money starts to flow. It's sort of like if you're looking for a girlfriend, you can never find one. When you give up, then you meet her, you know?
Yeah. Okay. So on a slightly different note, I noticed on Twitter a few months ago, maybe a month or so back, that you were taking legal action against someone for using one of your images without permission. And I was wondering, you know, I'm not so much thinking about going into the details because I know you may not be able to, but what sort of behavior will make you take action over something like that as opposed to sort of just letting it go, especially if it's just a personal use or private use, things like that?
Well, Martin, people don't like my stand on this subject quite often because they start to confuse their hard feelings about DRM on music with my position on copyright of photographs, and I don't think it's a fair comparison. But I rarely let anything go. Mm. I try to make sure that people know that I have a scorched earth policy when it comes to copyright infringement, and I don't want them to infringe my work. It's how I make my living, and there's no reason that they should have access to my photographs. So the behavior that triggers a lawsuit from me is the infringement, period.
Okay.
We sue every month. Every single month we sue somebody. Now, the case you're talking about, there was a young man who was a typical, you know, I'm 20 years old and I know everything because I'm on Twitter and you don't have any copyright and I'll do anything you want and you won't do a thing about it. So I decided in his case to get particularly aggressive, and within a few days he realized he'd made a huge mistake, sent me a big check and said he was sorry. And lots of times that's what happens, that they get to the point where they go, oops, and you know, they get a lawyer who tells them you're going to lose, and they pay us short of the actual litigation, which is fine by me. But I would prefer not to have to get to that point. So what we generally do is, as soon as we found out we were infringed, our attorney sends a demand letter for payment with an invoice for our standard usage agreement, whatever that might be for the particular usage that's involved. If they don't immediately pay it, and I mean like within 48 hours, all communications cut off with them and we just sue them. And at that point, it's going to be tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of dollars later.
I have very much the same stance in that, you know, I try not to let anything go. I mean, I will, if someone sort of links to it on a blog, then I'm not too worried. But, you know, for me, I just, it would take so much more for me to actually go to court over something like that, just because it's something for me that I don't have the machine in place to do that. You know, I don't have an attorney or, you know, a lawyer or something to help me with those things. And I guess, you know, at some point I'm going to need that. But definitely the thinking behind all of it is, I think we're pretty much on the same page. I'm definitely not one of the people that would get annoyed with your stance on that, because it's, I think you're right on the, you know, you've got to hit the nail on the head there.
Well, and some of it's educational. If I don't do that, then people don't realize what their rights are. As photographers, we own our images. Now, it's not enough to own them, though. In the United States, in order to really get any benefit from that ownership, you have to register the copyright, because that's the only way you can really get paid. So we register all of our work, and then I have some brilliant IT people who work with me who created a proprietary program we use to embed a digital watermark in every single image that I put online. And literally, there are times that within seconds of infringement, we're notified.
Wow.
And it searches a database that says, is this image licensed or not? If it's not, it immediately kicks us out an emergency email and sends us a digital fax and does all kinds of stuff. And we start the process of saying, hey, you stole my image and you're going to pay. It's just a question of how soon and how much. And now, if somebody asks me, I just want to make this clear, Martin, because I don't want to come off as mean about this. If some church group were to say, can I use your photograph to put on the back of our bulletin this week? I almost always say yes. Mm. So my stance is it's about the respect of, you know, recognizing my copyrights and just asking. I think I may have turned down one or two people in my career that asked for some, you know, real non-commercial use that in no way was going to harm me or my value of my images. I've said yes to almost all of those. So if anybody just asks, I'll give it to them. But if they don't ask, I'm going to treat it as if they walked into my house with a gun.
Mm. It's exactly the same as what I've been doing. I released a somewhat controversial podcast in the early days of this podcast, over 3 years ago, and I titled it "Don't Give Away Your Art." And I did make, basically it was targeted at people who sort of, you were saying earlier, you know, just for the I forget exactly how you worded it, but the pleasure of seeing your images in a publication or something like that. People are throwing their images at newspapers and magazines. And to me, you know, everybody should be trying to get at least something for their work. But one of the things that I did say there was that I've done the same, obviously not on the scale that you do, but I've been approached by profit, what do they call it? Profit-free, you know, the companies that don't supposedly make any money on magazines and things. I think one that I did was for a Buddhist publication or Buddhism publication, and I allowed them to use the image for free because, you know, they weren't really making any profit very much profit probably. And so, you know, if I think that I agree with the cause or the reasons, then I will allow people to use my images for free as well. But in general, you know, if someone wants to use it, people do, they come to you and they'll sort of email asking if they can use it, and they expect you to say, yeah, go ahead. But then when you look into it and you try to find out what they want to use it for, if it's in any way for a commercial use, I'll ask them for money. And 9 times out of 10 these days, they walk away. And you know.
Yeah, there's a perfect example. There's a prominent bird magazine that was going to start an online version. Mm. And this is a magazine that sells ads. And it's a magazine that charges a subscription fee, and it's been around for a long time. Mm. They saw one of my pictures and said, hey, we wanted to know if we could use some of your pictures and, you know, in return for free exposure. And I said, you know, the last time I went to the grocery store and tried to buy some milk with exposure, they ran me out of there. it's you guys are making money off the ads you're selling around my images. I want to get paid. Mm. It's not unreasonable. But if the church group or the local grade school, you know, they say, hey, we'd like to use your picture, you know, on our little, you know, choir cover, I'm like, sure, go ahead. It doesn't hurt me a bit. And there's no downside to that. But if they're making any kind of money, or if they're using it to advance a commercial venture, then we're going to get paid or we're going to say no. And you're right. A lot of people will reject you if you ask for money. And this is one of the big things I want to share right here, Martin. Don't be afraid to be rejected. It's okay. If you say no, what will happen is you'll build respect and people will see that you value your work. So when it comes time that they do have a budget, believe it or not, you're the person they'll come to.
Yeah, yeah. That's exactly what I'm hoping. I mean, it's happened a couple of times, but that's exactly what I'm hoping. I wish the rest of the world would start to jump onto this as well. It's definitely going in the wrong direction with a lot of the business practices around photography and stock photography at the moment.
Well, with millions of people buying digital single lens reflex cameras and calling themselves photographers, and people who, for the sake of an ego stroke, want to say, "Ooh, I got a picture in this magazine," and taking $50. Yeah, that's why I say, when I say that this is a competitive business, it's very hard, and everybody wants to be in a business that's creative as opposed to one that's not, and it's very tough. So you have to really stand out, and that's why we do what we call smiling and dialing here at 4:30 in the morning on the West Coast, because I have to be louder and quicker and more aggressive and more persistent than the other 200 guys that are going to call that editor that day.
Right. Yeah. I think, you know, the finding something to shoot that no one else has shot is very difficult as well. But I think you've got to also try to do it better than others in some way, and also to shoot something that other people don't have access to will help as well. But it's just so difficult to find that sort of thing these days. You know, everyone's been everywhere, so. You know,
there's a camera on every street corner of the world pretty much right now. So
right.
I don't think that you could say you've photographed something that nobody's ever seen for the most part. That is one reason I do like wildlife photography, is that a particular animal's behavior on any given day is going to be special.
Yeah.
And while you may have a picture of a Harris hawk,
yeah.
you probably don't have a picture of a Harris hawk landing full wingspread on a perch right in front of you like I do.
Right.
So, it's these kinds of things in wildlife where you get to do something. I have a very special photograph that I kind of probably shouldn't have taken, where I used a 20-millimeter lens to photograph two wolves on a deer carcass.
Mm.
And I'm 20 inches away from that deer carcass, and these wolves are eating the deer, and, I could be next. But... that's something that not everybody's going to have. There are plenty of photographs of wolves with long lenses, not very many with 20-millimeter lenses. So
if
you get something like that, it is a little different. But I will have to say, to bop the bubble a little bit, that take 200 guys that are better than me with better pictures than me, I'm going to outsell them.
Yeah, because of the smiling and dialing.
Yeah, it's because I'm going to be more aggressive on the marketing side. And the people who are buying these pictures, keep in mind – they don't have the love of this stuff that we do a lot of the times.
Mm.
I mean, to them, they work 9 to 5 at some magazine or some book publisher or, at some television production company, and you're just a task on their checklist. They, in the print world, they refer to what we do as they say, who's got art for this story? They call it the art.
Mm. Yeah.
They say, who's got the art for this story? I need 4 by 5 inches or 3 columns or whatever. That's as much attention as they pay to it. And once it's checked off their list, they get to go home and play golf or see their kids or do whatever.
Mm.
So, if you can get into that relationship where you make it easy for that person to check it off their list, you're going to get the sale, even if there's 10 better pictures than yours.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, that's wonderful stuff to chat about. I'm not only learning a lot myself, I'm sure that the listeners are going to love this.
I hope so. I hate to give this news that sounds a little negative.
Like I say, a dose of the truth is definitely necessary for most people in photography. So I'm not one for getting into these sort of slanging matches about gear and things like that, which manufacturer is the best. I think that the Nikon and the Canon argument, or the Mac and the Windows argument, is pretty lame, to be honest. But I do know that you have switched from Canon to Nikon, and I was wondering if you could share some of your reasons for that.
Yeah, I shot Canon for 17 years
and
was very happy with it, and the D3 came out.
Mm.
And everybody kept showing me D3s, and my buddy Fred Johnson, who at the time was working at Adobe and been on the podcast This Week in Photography with me, came by with his, and Steve Simon, who's on the podcast with me, came by with his. And so finally I thought, well, what the heck? I got a hold of one, and it was right after I'd bought the 1DS Mark III for $8,000 or $9,000. And I thought, well, I'll blow everybody's mind. I'll keep them both.
Well, I see.
I thought the rule is you're supposed to shoot one system. I thought, why? I'll shoot both. I'll shoot Canon when it's appropriate. I'll shoot Nikon. So I went out and I shot for 4 or 5 hours with the D3, and that was it, baby. I was like, oh, my gosh, I can't go back to my Canon, because it was just such an experience. Now, part of why I made this switch, Martin, is my particular brand of photography was perfectly suited for the D3. I shoot wildlife. I need very high speed, frame rates. I need very, very clean ISOs, and I need, very good, very fast autofocus. And those are the hallmarks of the D3. And just if I were like a wedding photographer or a portrait photographer, I wouldn't have changed, even though I thought the D3 was a cool camera. But in the kind of work I do, the D3 made the difference. So my plan was to shoot both, but I couldn't go back to the Canon after I shot the D3. So I sold everything of my Canon gear, and I now have 5 D3 bodies.
I keep
acquiring them because I keep saying, it'll like changing lenses. Let me throw one on that one. And they're going down in price. And my first one I paid $5,000 for. You can get them for $42 now.
Yeah, yeah. I was disappointed with the noise on the 1DS Mark III. I found that in some circumstances it can be pretty noisy even at ISO 400. So, you know,
yeah, it's a different world when you know that ISO 6400 is still cool.
Yeah. I bought it as a second body, mainly before going for my Hokkaido workshop in February, but I've now got the 5D Mark II as well. I've simply got too much investment. I'm sure you did as well, but I've got a lot of investment in glass, and I can't really even think about switching. But
believe me, it was not what I wanted to do. It was nowhere on my agenda, and I think Canon gear is, you know, the Canon's made some great cameras. I think of late they've fallen behind on the autofocus in particular. Mm. If you're a wildlife or a sports shooter, if you're not, it doesn't matter a bit. The 5D Mark II is a great camera. Mm. If you're not a wildlife or a sports shooter, it's going to solve 95% of your problems. And to quote Michael Reichman, publisher of the Luminous Landscape, 98% of all cameras and lenses are better than 99% of all photographers.
I love that.
It's not the camera. You know, we've all heard it. I show my cranes in the fire mist shot at a gallery, and a little old lady walks up to me and says, "You must have a really good camera."
Yeah.
I said, "Yeah, I bought it at that same place that Shakespeare gets his pins."
Oh, dear. I love it. Yeah, I think it's so cool that you did that. The switch. I thought you were going to say for a moment that you had kept both, but I can see where you're coming from. You know, just not being able to go back. Once something feels right, it's difficult to use something else.
Now, if Canon made a camera that competed with the D3, who knows? I may switch back. I will say this: I've been disappointed with Nikon's service.
Ah, okay.
I like the camera a lot. Canon always gave me great service. But Nikon's motto when it comes to service is, "We're not happy till you're not happy." So, and I realize that the Nikon fanboys will hate me because I said something against my own brand, but it's just true. At least in my experience, I have not had much luck getting things done properly from Nikon service, and I've needed more service than I thought I should need, you know, with brand new gear. That's the only negative so far about the switch, and of course having to learn how to do everything backwards.
Yeah, that's something that I've picked a Nikon up, I was starting to sort of try and say that your way then, a Nikon, but
I know in Japan it's Nikon and we say Nikon.
I've picked them up in stores. I've used friends just to sort of see how they feel. I actually really do like the feel of the Nikon bodies. I like the knurled knobs and things, but you know, the fact that to me the zoom ring and everything goes the other way around is a little bit.
It took me quite a lot of practice. I would literally just sit in my office and every 10 minutes pick it up and zoom it and take on and off to force myself, because you know, 17 years of yanking one way, and now having to yank the other.
Yeah.
That was problematic, but I am really loving the SB900 flash.
Oh, right,
It's an awesome flash unit, and some of the Nikon glass is pretty astounding. The 14-24 2.8 is to die for. Mm. 24-70 2.8 is to die for, but now here's some of the differences. The Canon makes a much better 70-200 2.8. The Nikon 70-200 2.8 on the full-frame bodies has got more vignetting than any camera lens I've touched in 37 years.
Really?
Wow. Yeah. And it's a new top-of-the-line lens. So it's like anything else. There's no perfect solution. And a lot of people are surprised to find out that I shoot a couple of Sigma lenses on a regular basis, which doesn't have anything to do with Canon or Nikon.
That's interesting.
Yeah, I use the Sigma 3-800 5.6 is my number one lens.
Wow. I had heard a few things about the 14mm that someone was questioning. I bought a 14 in Canon. They only have like a prime 14. There's a two version.
I used to own that lens, the rectilinear correction.
Yeah,
it's a great lens.
It is. I bought one. I borrowed one from a friend in a park a few months back, and I actually almost called into the camera shop on the way back from the park and picked it up. It was that good. But I decided to hold off until I got home and looked at the images on my PC. But I literally went out and bought it the next day. But I've been shooting some things with this over the last few months that I love it. But when I mentioned that I'd bought the Prime, somebody jumped on me on Twitter immediately and why it's, you know, it's not as sharp as the Zoom. You mentioned, is it 14-24 or something? The one that you mentioned earlier.
The Nikon 14-24 2.8.
Yeah, that they were saying that it's sharper than the Prime, and I wondered what they were talking about, and then I realized that they were talking about the Nikkor lenses. So I said, yeah, the problem is it won't fit on my Canon body.
Well, and once again, the person that said that, I'd bet dollars to donuts they couldn't make it sharper.
Maybe so.
I mean, there's some technique involved in getting that lens to be sharp.
Yeah. So, let's move on a little bit. Many of my listeners here on this podcast also listen to, I'm sure most of my listeners listen to This Week in Photography. And I noticed that you hadn't been on the show as much recently, and as much as you were before, at least. And I was wondering if that's a permanent thing or if we're going to see you on there a little bit more in the future.
Well, I don't know who really cares about this story, but I'll try to explain it as best I can. Alex and I talked about doing a photography podcast years ago. We've known each other a long time. Alex Lindsay from the Pixel Corps.
Yeah.
And I agreed to do one. And about that time, Discovery Channel asked me to create some stuff for them and offered me some money to do it. I asked Alex if he wouldn't mind if I begged out. And he put the photography show on hold for a year. I finished my obligation contractually to the Discovery Channel and then said, cool, I'm now available. So we started the show and we made an agreement. I would own the blog. He would own the podcast.
I see.
And we would do some revenue splits. And there's not a lot of money in this, as you know. I mean, everyone has this crazy notion that, you know, we support ourselves and buy Bentleys off what we make on the podcast. And it just couldn't be further from the truth. Mm. But so, you know, I said, well, I'll do it for a year or so and see what happens. Well, a year came and went. I mean, it was really fast. Mm. I did a year with the show. And I just decided that, you know, I had a lot of other projects I wanted to do, and hosting the show along with Alex was a lot more work than I wanted to do in something where I didn't control the financial interest. So I asked him if he wouldn't mind if I just made myself available as a guest, and he said he totally understood, and we're very good friends still. And so I run the blog and he runs the podcast, and now I appear, if anybody noticed, I did like 6 videos with TWIP at PMA, so everyone keeps saying, well, you're not on the show. Well, I was on 6 times.
I saw that, yeah.
It's just that I'm not co-hosting.
I see.
And anytime you asked me to be a guest on your show, I came. Victor started a new podcast called The Typical Shutterbug. He asked me to be a guest on his show, I came. And anytime Alex asked me to be a guest, I'll be there. So it's really up to Alex. Now, you know, I'm focusing on the blog, and I got another project, you know, going on. You might have noticed I launched a new podcast having to do with storage, which, of course, is of great interest to photographers because they got to do some of their photos. Yeah. So that's taken some of my time. And I may do another photo podcast of my own that I control someday, provided I can work it out in such a way that it doesn't harm TWIP, because I don't want to do anything to compete with my friends. But everybody loves everybody. There's no problem. It's just, you know, my schedule is quite full, and I have to take a look at what was best for me and my business given the limited time I have and the lots of opportunities facing me.
Yeah, I had noticed that you do most of the posting on the blog there, and so I know that you're still very much involved with that.
And I write about 3 posts a day.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's not most of the posting. That's pretty much all of it.
Well, yeah, I was trying to be a little bit politically correct, but every post there has your name against it. So, I mean, I was really asking more because, you know, I kind of miss you on there as well. I'd not listened to it for a while, for a long time. I didn't, but when it came to my attention, I've been listening to it pretty much trying to catch up for the last few months or so. So it's always nice to hear you on there.
Well, thank you. But for every person that likes me on there, there's one who doesn't. So it's okay, because I have a media background. So, you know, I'm controversial for a reason, because that's really what people want. I mean, even if people say they hate you, they listen.
Right.
And Rush Limbaugh makes $40 million a year having half his audience hate him. So I have strong opinions. I'm willing to own them. That offends some people that come from places where you're not supposed to express your opinions that way. And I'll defend my positions. I'll stand behind them. I'll argue with people. That's not everybody's style. And I'm like, that's okay. You know, there's lots of podcasts. Go listen to another one. The people that do like it, listen. The people that don't. I never want to offend anybody. But trust me, there are plenty of people that are glad I'm gone.
Well, I've seen this on Twitter. I follow you on Twitter. And I noticed that you've been saying over the last few days that people have been, griping at you for giving too much stuff away. And I thought,
isn't it great? America's the only place in the world where people complain about getting too much stuff. It's like, sir, I'm really upset with you. You gave me all this gold, but you did not give me a card to carry
exactly.
in. I'm going to sue you.
Right. I saw that that tweet where someone had said that. That's just so funny.
Listen, jealousy is pervasive on the internet. And when you get to be 13 feet tall in your mom's basement, nobody has to really know who you are. It's easy to say anything. I just take all this stuff. Do you know that when I switched to Nikon, Martin, I got death threats?
Oh, no.
Three death threats from people, as if they had any reason to be concerned about what camera I shoot. The internet is full of crazy stuff, and I just like, whatever. Yeah. I do what I do. People who enjoy it, I'm glad to help them. People who don't enjoy it, I invite them to go someplace where they'll have fun. Life's too short to be mad all the time.
Mm. Yeah, exactly.
If you're a sad, bitter person when you start listening to my shows, you'll still be a sad, bitter person after. If you're a happy person who's looking to have fun, well, you'll get some information, and that's the way it is. And I apologize for my straight talk, but that's the only thing I know how to do.
No way, no reason to apologize at all. It's refreshing. So I have listened to the first episode of Managing Your Digital Life. I thought it was a great podcast, a great launch. Tell us a little bit more about that. You know, what's that all about? Where's it going to go?
Well, thanks for asking. MYDL.me instead of .com.me. Managing Your Digital Life is about storage, backup, archiving. And one of the reasons I started the show was that I have two very close friends who are wedding photographers who lost their entire life's work, one to a fire and one to a computer theft.
Wow.
And the guy who lost it to the fire, it was in the negatives days, and there wasn't a lot he could have done to back up his negatives when the place burned down. Mm. The fellow years after that in Miami, a friend of mine, he had his computer stolen off of his desk out of his studio, and he had not backed up, and he had his entire life's work on that computer.
Wow.
And so basically, 15, 20 years of his life, including many weddings he had shot and digitized, they're just gone. And they're never coming back. And I thought to myself, I know a lot of photographers, and we've done some polls, the ones that are candid about it, maybe as high as 20-25% have never done any kind of backup, Martin. Mm. And it scares me, and I worry for them. So one of the reasons we're doing this is that, my 401k is the 500,000 images I've collected over my career. And when I can't shoot anymore and I'm sitting in my wheelchair and I'm all crippled up, I'm still going to be smiling and dialing, selling those photographs. I have to be able to make sure they're accessible to me. Yeah. So we're doing this show to help teach people about things like hard drive failure and backup strategy and archive. And I'm very lucky to have my friend Andy Anacco, who is the technology columnist for the Chicago Sun-Times as well as Macworld Magazine. He's written for Playboy. He's written for all kinds of prestigious publications. He's on the show with me, and we have special guests. Our first guest was Leo. We've got Chris Breen coming up in a future episode to talk SSD drives. We've got Steve Gibson coming up. He knows everything about hard disk in the world. We've got lots of special people coming on. If you're interested in the show, it's at mydl.me. And as photographers, I do think we should pay some attention to our backup strategy and make sure that we've got not only an on-site backup but an off-site backup so that if somebody steals your computer and the Drobo sitting next to it, you'll have another one at home so that you can at least get your images back.
I totally agree. It's so important. I worry here in Tokyo. I mean, I've got three things that I do. One is that I've got a couple of bays in the front of my PC. I built a large, a large computer with space to put some bays in. So I just stick a terabyte drive in there every so often and sync everything up and then take it and put it in the office. But that's although it's on the other side of town, it's still in Tokyo, and Tokyo is like on a huge fault. It's almost almost the same as over in California. So I do worry still. The other things that I do I have it was years ago now. I haven't done it for a long time. Wrote everything to DVDs, and I have those at my brother's house in the UK. And the UK's had like one earthquake in 50 years, so I think we're probably safe there. But
you just have to hope that DVDs are still readable 10 years from now when you might.
Well, exactly. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, it just takes so long. I've thought about Blu-ray, but that technology is still a little bit. Yeah, I don't really think right now that I'm so interested in sticking on a disc because there's so much uncertainty. But I do have hard disk copies of everything. I've got two copies in different locations. And I use Mozy, but that, for me, I think it's partly because I'm uploading from Tokyo. It just takes so long. I can only get about 3 gigabytes up a day. And so It just takes so long to get caught up. So, you know, I've got to figure out something else. I want an easier way to get things over to the UK without, you know, having to spend so long or spend a long time burning the discs.
Well, my friend Alex Lindsay has a rule that at least if it's not in two places, it doesn't exist. We're a little bit more fanatical here. We have a rule that says if it's not in five places, it doesn't exist.
I'd like to get there.
Yeah, we just put it into the workflow. Any of my master gallery images end up in five different locations and in two different states. Mm. And, you know, nothing in this world is foolproof. That much I know. But if I've done what I can to back up and I've made every potential precaution, you know, make sure it's taken, then if something happens, at least I won't be mad at myself.
Yeah, yeah.
I did lose images one time in my career to a bad hard drive. And ever since then, I'm sort of a freak about this. And that's really why we're doing the show.
Mm, yeah. Okay. Well, I'm looking forward to following that. And, you know, I don't know if I need to do this, but good luck with that. I'm sure it's going to go amazingly well.
Well, we're very fortunate that we had a nice launch and very lucky to have my friend Leo help me get the show off the ground and looking forward to finding out what's going on and seeing what we can do to make sure photographers have the information they need to be properly backed up, and then I can go to sleep at night and not worry about their photos after I'm not worried about them.
Great stuff. So, Scott, let's start to think about wrapping this up. Where can people find you apart from TWIP and of course the mydl.me now? I know you're on Twitter.
Yep, Scott Bourne, all one word, Scott Bourne, like the Bourne identity, although I'm not getting my royalty checks. And, you know, scottbourne.com is sort of an aggregator. It's a Tumblr blog is what it is, but all my feeds end up there. So scottbourne.com is the easiest way to find out what I'm up to or on the Twitter. I tend to Twitter a lot. I don't know why I enjoy it. It's one of those few things that I actually have come to enjoy. So I'm on the Twitter a lot, and I post at twipphoto.com every day. So I'm sort of like a rash. I'm everywhere.
Yeah, on Twitter, I generally catch up on my iPhone. I use one of the I think it's Twitter phone with an F that I use to catch up there, and I'm sort of every day it loads when I get up. I follow that many people that I hit the max of 200 tweets every morning when I get up, and so I flick through. And whenever I see your little yellow icon with the cartoon guy go down there, I stop and read those. So
thank you. That's supposed to be a Tommy Bahama shirt, which is my trademark.
I've seen that. Yeah, it's so really cool.
That's supposed to be. It's actually, I believe, I think they call them Mimos. I think there's a site that one of our staff did that at. But I can't see. That's the thing I don't like about Twitter. I can't follow everybody I want to because it just gets too noisy.
Yeah, it's difficult. I mean, do you have any strategy? What do you do? It's like,
Martin, I wish I had a strategy. I mean, everybody asks me how I got so many followers, and I say, I have no idea. I don't have a strategy. I just basically get on there and say whatever the heck I feel like saying. And so far, enough people want to hang out and see what that is that it's been worth my time. As far as reading stuff goes, I only follow 100 people, and they tend to be people I actually know or care about.
Oh, okay.
So on the reading side, that's my strategy. I mean, everybody says you're supposed to auto-follow, but if I auto-followed, I'd have 13,000 people stream. There's not a chance I would be able to see anybody's stuff. So I apologize to anyone that's offended that I'm not following them, but I just can't follow everybody. And as it is, I get 2,000 emails minimum a week, sometimes a day, and we got so much noise coming in that I need to have some sort of sanity.
You know, you've just made me feel all humbled and honored again because you you followed me a few weeks ago, so thanks for that.
Well, and I apologize for taking so long, but see, that's just it. I to weed through and find the people I want to follow. Sometimes I have to really confess, I'm such a Luddite when it comes to some of this stuff. There was a time in my life when everyone considered me a technology guru, and now I'm far from it. But it took me months to figure out even what following meant and how to do it. So I mean, that's how stupid I am. I finally figured it out. I said, oh, so that's what that does, and. And then it took me months to figure out that I was supposed to reply to people. I mean, it was just – it was horrid. My launch on Twitter, the first 3 or 4 months, I just completely washed that away as having been the least effective time I spent because I didn't know what I was doing. And there's – you know, it's not like there's a manual for the thing. It's brand new. And sure. I do not care for the people that try to tell me how to use it though. So I think it's an important – frankly, I think it's going to be a very important tool for photographers.
Yeah.
I think, you know, connecting with the right people. I noticed that a lot of my editors at some of the publications that I've shot for are following me now.
Mm.
Wow. So that's kind of cool because they know that I'm about, for instance, they know I'm about to go shoot in Yellowstone. Mm. They know that I've got I'm doing another bear shoot in July of 2010 at Katmai. So they're starting to make their plans for what images they might want from me just by seeing my Twitter stream.
Mm. I found it the most useful thing that I've found for it so far. I mean, and I'm enjoying it as well. I don't tweet that much, but when I was over in Hokkaido doing my workshop, there was times when we'd get a little pocket of signal. Most of the locations we're at, there is no signal. But every so often when we were traveling between locations, I'd have the iPhone out and I'd notice the little signal bar go up. And so I'd tweet about what we were doing, where we were, how things were going. And that sort of generated a lot of interest, and I thought that it was great that you can't always get a laptop out when you're in the middle of something like that, but a phone, it's in your hand anyway or in your pocket, and it was so much easy. It was really easy just to sort of give people a quick update while we were between locations. So that was pretty cool.
Oh, I absolutely think that's cool. I mean, I've done a lot of that. I live tweeted the Panasonic press conference, the announcement of the GH1 from PMA this year.
Oh, right.
And I got a lot of positive feedback that a lot of people were just, they were sort of rapt, you know, attention on what I was doing. Mm. And people seemed to like the real-time nature of it as opposed to me taking that information down and then, you know, later writing something about it.
Mm.
So it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, I sometimes, although as much as I love Japan and living here, I'm snoring when you're doing those tweets. So it's like, you know, I'm on the wrong side of the world to catch that stuff real time, which is a bit of a negative aspect. But anyway, so Scott, it's been absolutely wonderful talking to you, and we'll wrap it up here. But I just wanted to say thank you and thanks again for the interview that you did in January and everything, and it's been a pleasure and an honor.
Well, I feel the same way, Martin. I really am a fan of what you do, and I think I have a lot to learn about you from your peaceful nature and your approach, which is about a million degrees opposite of what I do. And maybe I could find some things I could take from what you do. So I appreciate it.
Although you say that, you know, I think you're not where you are today because you're an unlikable person.
Yeah, but I really suck at suffering fools gladly.
I'm with you there. I'm with you there. Okay, well, anyway, thanks very much, Scott. It really has been
okay.
A pleasure.
Hope to talk to you soon.
You too. Bye-bye. Martin Bailey Photography Podcast is a proud member of the Photocast Network. Find this and other great photography podcasts at photocastnetwork.com.